Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, April 25th, 2015. Many topics to cover tonight. Greece, a couple days away from defaulting on their loans to the World Bank. And I think it's going to go that way. I think they're going to actually default. Greece is at a point where they can't give it anymore. And what they're trying to do with the World Bank is they're saying, oh, well, we'll just give you more loans. We'll come in and bail you out with loans. But they demand more austerity in Greece. And basically what they're doing is they're not paying the people their Social Security, their retirements, their, you know, any type of retirements. This all being confiscated by the government. And the people literally can't give anymore. I mean, you can't get blood out of a turnip. And so they have no place to go. But the end result is if they default, they will be golden in the sense of being adapted into a large part of the world, which has basically turned their backs on the World Bank. Norway is the one country in Europe that is not in the euro. And, of course, part of this is dumping the euro as a means of currency. Germany is the one that's holding the bag primarily on this. So the Chancellor Merkel is up there hoping to get some kind of a solution. But, you know, there's just no more to be had out of Greece. They can't rob anymore from those people. And so, by the way, I want you to do this, my crowd being a bit more educated than the rest of the planet. Go get a picture off the internet of Merkel. She's the High Chancellor of Germany. Put it next to the picture of Nancy Leader, crazy lady, Zeta Talk, talks to aliens, you know, Planet X was supposed to destroy Earth May 15th, 2003, which of course never happened, in all of the publicity that went with that. But look, take a picture of those two yahoos and put them side by side, compare them. Tell me if those two are not coming out of the same mold. And take your own set of conclusions following that. But at any rate, I'm not going to talk too much more about this. Of course, the World Bank has other ways to pressure countries into signing up for more loans and putting more austerity programs on their people. So this will be interesting. We'll see. But I think that Greece is actually going to pull the plug just like Iceland did. Arresting the European bankers, convicting them of high treason and crimes, throwing them in prison. As I was saying, Norway, a country is not in the euro, is the most successful, profitable country in Europe. What does that tell you? That the euro is a big drag on everybody. So, anyway, that's something to see. The 10 most peaceful countries in the world were voted in. I just saw this on the internet. Iceland being the most peaceful country in the world. Interesting. Also that they have thrown out the international bankers. I wonder if that goes hand in hand. Denmark, this is in order of the most peaceful. So Iceland first, Denmark second, then Austria, New Zealand, all of those peace-loving people down there, down under. Switzerland, Finland, Canada, Japan, Australia, and the Czech Republic. So interesting. The most peaceful places on Earth. Just again, a quick note, the plethora, the vast, unbelievable amount of predictions that are coming out, not for me, but from everybody else on the planet. And I have to be careful how I say this because there are people just gunning for me to say something about Nibiru Planet X or something like that and then paste it together to make it sound like I'm making a prediction. So I have to be careful not to even say what other people are predicting because then they could cut and paste that with other things. It's a pretty crazy world out there. But at any rate, the predictions, whether it's for Nibiru, asteroids crashing into Earth, I talked about this last week. As of yet, I have not gotten any data that would suggest that any of this is true. In fact, what we're finding is people are mouse copying or paraphrasing or whatever predictions that were made back in 2011. And so there's all of this going on, but the real bottom line is if there's something that's going to happen, it requires real astronomical data in a format, not only, oh, here's a picture, a pretty picture of a thing up in the sky, or here's somebody that said something. No, you need astronomical data. It's in a format that is standard in the astronomical community, and it has not only position, but orbital data. And that would allow, and also magnitude, all of the data that goes with this, so that somebody could actually sit down, myself included, and verify it. And as of yet, nobody has come across with this. There's these general, bland, meaningless predictions that have no validity at all, because they simply, and some of them are just ludicrous. So I'm not going to waste more time on that, other than there is no data that's been presented that has any validity at all. Yesterday we got hit with a CME which did nothing. And so with all of the talk about CMEs, yes, there could be deadly CMEs, things that cause a lot of problems. But the one that hit yesterday, direct hit on Earth's magnetosphere, really did nothing. It was like, a lower M-class flare. But that's not to say that it can't happen, but yesterday, and actually the sun continues to be very quiet. Although weather-wise, around the world, a huge storm moving into India right now, off the South Indian Ocean there, right in the eastern side, moving westerly into India. The entire central band of the world is fairly excited with storm activity. Some storms moving across southern Japan right now. And it could be a mild interaction with the CME that passed yesterday. In fact, this very likely could be that even though standard science doesn't recognize any interaction of that CME with Earth, the weather is reflecting it around the world. Quick topic. I'm not going to spend really much time talking about my wing generator project. It's doing well on the crowdfunding page. We're finding out some issues there with the actual some things going on in the background, let's say, in what I might just describe it as, is resistance. As you might expect, something that's really a solution going to receive resistance. But I'm not going to dwell on that, because I live with that all the time. I've lived with that my entire career. Since back in the early days, the old Cornell days, 1979 to 81, from that day forward, I have basically had to swim upstream, not upstream, but up, like trying to swim up Niagara Falls with the misinformation and the negativity and the et cetera. It's just been constant throughout my entire career, so it's nothing new. But all I'm going to tell you is with what has happened so far, this is going to be a success. This is going to be out there. The 12-meter wing generator is going to be a reality. And I'm putting some of my own money with this, just to tell you that some people think, oh, he's probably just making money. No, I'm putting my own money along with what people are putting in out there. And I guarantee you, I'm putting a lot more money into this than any other single person out there. But I still want people to go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and make a contribution. It could be $5 or $10 or something like that. But just put in your vote and say, yes, I support this. And the world will be a better place once we start to replace the central energy facilities. Just a comment on listener feedback. I've gotten feedback, I'm not going to say specifically from where, but around the world, where people have terrible, terrible electrical service. And I'm getting wind of this through, communication directly with me from people around the world. And this product, the 12-meter wing generator, is just in high demand already. I was on an interview yesterday with Brian Porter. He's got a show up out of Ottawa on the Revolution Radio Network. It's called I Am Nature, and I had an interview yesterday. there, and he said, why aren't the politicians that are so-called green, why aren't the companies that are so-called green, why aren't these people pounding the way to your door to give you a lot of support? And of course, he was being facetious because he already knows the answer, is because green and alternative energy are farces. They are meant to be something to make people feel good. There's a green candidate out. He's going to demand by 2050, we're going to have solved the world's energy problems with alternative energy. These people are just imitation posture, nobody, you know, trying to ride a wave, but they don't have any plan. How do you legislate green energy? How do you legislate it when it's not possible given the alternative energy situations that have been presented and promoted by big corporations? You know, the whole idea of green and alternative energy has been promoted by the companies that have financial interest in nuclear, in coal, in oil, in big energy. You know, so they're sucking up the government subsidy money just like Johnny B. Goode, but there's no plan, believe me, out there except for mine that's really meant to replace that central power generator. Okay, well, enough of that. Just go to the website, my website, click on the link and go and make a donation. And I know there's a lot of people sitting back there that are waiting for everybody else to do it, but I'd like for you to become part of this also. And like I say, it's going to succeed. There's a lot more yet to be done in terms of I'm doing a lot of radio interviews now promoting this. It's going to happen. It's going to be there, and I hope that you are going to be part of that. Oh, did I mention that one last thing, on my sales page, if you buy water filters, water filter elements, 10-pack, or any products, my books, the Recalendar Sunstar clock, or any of the other products there on my web page, on the sales page, I'm going to give 50% of the profit into the Wing Project. And that's a way, of, in case people need products, etc., that's a way for you to get something that you need. And by the way, the prices are already discounted there on all the water filter products, the main ones. The prices are 10% or in some cases more discount. So you're going to get great prices, plus help the Wing Generator Project. It's just another way to help. Or take the link, mouse copy it from my page, and send it out to your friends. And some of them will contribute. Some of them will find it's a great idea. Okay, on to the main science topic. I do want to mention something in general about crowdfunding. And crowdfunding may be a bit new to some of you out there, or the idea of going to a web page and throwing in a small donation towards something you believe in. A lot of products are being developed today because of crowdfunding. And if this is going to grow, I'm kind of on the initial cusp of this. So I'm one of the experimenters and certainly one of the pioneers in the idea of actually doing something that'll change the world. Because if you go to standard investment capital, venture capitalists, to invest in something like this that's really going to change the energy world, you know what? They're going to take your idea. They're going to stall you. They're going to do everything in the world to prevent you from succeeding. And I've been down that road, so I know. And if they ever leak it, which they always do, to the major oil or energy industry, they're going to come in and shut those people down right away and threaten them. And this happens. This is the way it works. So the reality of venture capital, the old-style venture capital funding projects, doesn't work. And how many projects have failed because they try and suck up the information and then scuttle it? But with crowdfunding, it's a whole different deal. It's because people out there see a great idea, they want to make it succeed, and they contribute directly to it. And so it's just a whole different venue. And that's why crowdfunding is becoming bigger and bigger. It's like the internet. You can get out there and make a comment too. Whereas before, the old way, the news media was controlled and nobody was able to get a word in edgewise. Okay, on to the main science topics. Last week, I did not have time to mention this. There's some yo-yo running around the internet and through glossy internet magazines, etc., saying that the Russian space program, the shuttle, the Russian shuttle, which basically looks pretty much like the U.S. shuttle, there are many technical differences. For example, the Russian shuttle does not have main engines that run off the central tank. The Russian shuttle has some maneuvering rockets on it, but it does not incorporate the engines into the main liftoff thrust. That's all done by a secondary rocket system. And by the way, the Russians use kerosene in their big heavy lift rockets. That's their main fuel, is kerosene. But at any rate, this clown's running around saying that the Russians took one flight with this, it didn't work, they brought it back, and they shut it down. No, that's totally, totally false. And anybody who knows anything about the Russian space program knows that their shuttle program was highly successful. It ran from around 1986. It really got going around 1988, and it ran to 1993 with hundreds and hundreds of launches. Back in the 60s, the Russians had a small three-man shuttle craft, re-entry craft, called the Cosmos. And I have pictures of that. I forget what book it's in. It might be in my weather book. Pictures of the Cosmos craft. And they had thousands of flights with that. They had like something like 1,500 men in space on a daily basis from the 1960s, while we were all waiting around for the Gemini spacecraft to attach to one another, etc., and then the Apollo craft and all of that, and then the so-called moon shots, etc. The Russians had thousands of people in outer space, and that was the three people. They put it up on the nose of their big boosters because they had so much extra lift capability. They, you know, it was wasted, so they put this little mini shuttle up there, and they flew back in every day. They were up in space every day while we were waiting months and months and months for the next Apollo program. But back to the main space shuttle program in Russia, it was highly successful. They had many, many launches using it, but they realized, too, that the shuttle was really kind of a pig. You are launching all this weight, which really didn't do anything. You wanted a few guys up there, some cosmonauts, etc., and then a payload, but they had all of that and more with just their rocket systems. So they didn't need a shuttle. The shuttle was it was a very expensive program in Russia. In fact, it was their most expensive part of their space program. So when they shut it down, it was a giant relief to the rest of the Russian space program. And right now, the U.S. military and NASA both use Russian space program lift vehicles to get up into space because the U.S. doesn't have anything. So at any rate, there's this tremendous effort now that a new Cold War is beginning. And by the way, there's been a tremendous amount of troop movement, calling up of troops in the United States. The people in the know expect something, and it appears to be related to the Ukraine, issues over in the Ukraine. So that's just a side note. But the Russian space shuttle program, highly successful, ran over well over a half of a decade. And if you looked at the true history there, it would far overshadow all of the launches done by the United States. And they never had any major human loss accidents with their shuttle. We had two, of course, major losses with our shuttle program. I don't call it my shuttle program, NASA's shuttle program. Okay, the main science topic, I'm talking tonight about three things: the New Horizon going to Pluto, the Rosetta mission, and then also the Cassini mission at Titan in the news this week. So I want to concentrate on these space science issues because they're very, very important to understand what's going on. I made a posting on my page about Pluto, and a long time ago, I don't remember, I know it was certainly months ago, I made a prediction that they would see comet activity at Pluto. Lo and behold, the first pictures that were let out, it was around the end of May, the first part of June, they took the first pictures of the Pluto system. There are five moons known at Pluto, and it was kind of a, this is with the long distance camera, and when that was processed, when the photos were processed, you could see the comet activity swirling around Pluto as the moons whipped around Pluto. And so this confirmed my prediction that Pluto would act like a comet. We already know that Pluto has an atmosphere. It turns out that maybe at least one of the moons, Charon, and possibly other ones have an atmosphere. And the other ones are small. I mean, they're not big moons. But you see the tail activity whipping around with the orbital motion of the moons of Pluto. And so what the point is after those photos came out, NASA shut down the New Horizon data release. They have not released a single photo since. They have some animations based on some animator's concept, but I mean, that's hardly science, excuse me. Some guy animating, it's goofy. But that's what NASA started back even in the Voyager days, in the Pioneer days, started to animate planetary encounters with spacecraft. And I could smell a rat in the closet right then because, animating, making up basically like a Walt Disney cartoon. In fact, they were Walt Disney animators. That's where they got the animators from. So at any rate, the point is NASA has not released a single shred of data from the New Horizon spacecraft. And it's July 14th. I mean, we're just like 2 weeks away, 3 weeks away from the closest approach of this spacecraft at Pluto. And NASA is, do you think that spacecraft getting closer and closer, it's taking probably thousands of pictures a day of the Pluto system. They're not releasing anything. And I know why, because it's Pluto is acting like a comet. And, you know, there certainly shouldn't be any dirty snowball comet model activity out by Pluto. I mean, the sun out there is so weak, it's silly. But the point is that comets are not dirty snowballs. And once again, this is proof. Interestingly enough, Hal Weaver is the chief scientist on this, and he's a comet scientist. So that tells me that long ago, NASA had realized that Pluto is exhibiting cometary activity. And they probably saw enough of this with the Hubble Space Telescope and possibly other telescopes, the X-rays, all the other things that go along with comets. They saw these, probably radio telescope image of the hydrogen cloud, the ionized hydrogen cloud that surrounds a comet. So they could see all of these effects from a distance, the electrical activity, the magnetic field activity, the line splitting of the spectrum, etc., all the things that go along with a comet. And so they detected this. So who do they put in charge? Hal Weaver, a comet guy. So it doesn't get any better than this. But as I said, those pictures are going to be so doctored by the time they come out of NASA, you're not going to be able to recognize anything. And Hal Weaver is a specialist in doctoring data. We've already seen that back even in the old Hale-Bopp days. He was doctoring photos, changing, removing information. We caught him doing it. Yep, that's what's going on. That's science at its worst. But I'm keeping an eye on that every day I look to try and see if anything has been released, and no. So we're well into close to the end of June here. and not a trace of information coming out of NASA for the whole month of June. Literally, that spacecraft has been gathering data and being basically sequestered and hidden by NASA. Next in the news, I want to talk about the Rosetta mission. This past week, they released something like 1,600 photos, and then a couple days later, they released, I think it was 52 photos, close-up photos of the comet nucleus. And it's this last set of 50 photos that I want to concentrate on. What happened is they let the lander, Philae is the name of the lander, released from the Rosetta mission. This is back in, the date when Philae went down to land on the comet. But as it orbited in around the comet nucleus, it was taking pictures like nose to nose, 100 yards away, taking pictures of the comet nucleus. No water, no carbon dioxide, no jetting was coming off of this nucleus. And, if there was jetting of some kind, it certainly would have picked it up in all of the photos that were taken. So clearly, there's nothing coming off the comet nucleus. And so let me make a statement right here and right now. The Dirty Snowball Comet model, in fact, at a press release at the Paris Air Show, the staff of the Rosetta mission had a press release there. They stated, the lead scientist there that was giving the data, he said unequivocally, the Dirty Snowball Comet model is not correct. He said it's completely wrong. And literally, there's nothing coming off the nucleus. And so this guy looked kind of like, and I'm going to use kind of a crude expression here, but it's about the best one I can find. This guy looked like he kind of had a pole sticking up his behind. And I, excuse me, youth out there listening. This guy, every time he said something, he looked around like somebody was listening and watching what he said. He had to be extremely careful, and he was reading, basically reading what he was saying. And so the only thing he could say is that Dirty Snowball Comet model was incorrect. Okay. Then he goes and he says the dust that they've discovered, which is hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen compounds, organic compounds, dust on the comet nucleus, then he goes, oh, that's from the beginning of the solar system. I mean, no evidence, no reason for saying that other than that's the politically correct thing that he had to say. And every time he said something, he looked around like he was worried that somebody was going to, press a button and blow him up or something. Very, very cautious. But the bottom line is, nothing is coming off the comet nucleus. The dust that's accumulated, he attributed to the beginning of the solar system, meaning at least that the dust was not coming off the comet nucleus. It was being accumulated, or at one time, he says 4.5 billion years ago, I say right now, is being accumulated on the comet nucleus from outside. In other words, the dust was not a product of the comet nucleus. And so, as this spacecraft, Philae, orbited at close range, like I say, 100 yards away, nose to nose, you could actually see the dust grains, fine dust grains on the surface. That's how close they were. 50 pictures, and the entire comet's surface covered with this powder. Nothing coming off the nucleus. So, literally, okay, there was the main propounded comet model for the past more than 50 years, since 1950 when Fred Whipple proposed that comet model. Back then it was called the Ice Ball Comet Model, then it was the Dirty Ice Ball Comet Model, then it was the Dirty Snowball Comet model. And those were the changes. And I lived in my scientific career through all of those changes. In fact, in 1986, when the ICEE-3 satellite, which was monitoring the solar radiation, and I knew those scientists at Goddard who were running that program, when they diverted that, James Farquhar diverted that to go out to the comet Jacobini-Zinner, they renamed it ICE-3, meaning ice, expecting the ice ball comet model. That's the period of time when it was still called ice ball. Then it converted into snowball, dirty snowball, and etc. But at any rate, nothing is coming off the comet nucleus. There's another set of clowns copying my material out there and copying the terminology. And when they first started, they started using even my term plasma discharge comet model, but it became so obvious that they were copying me that they had to change the name. They called their baloney the electric comet and said that rock was changing from the comet nucleus into water, and that's where the water came from in the tail. Well, it's very clear now that that baloney is totally incorrect also, which is good because that now those people can go back to grandma's basement and they can pick their nose like they had been for the, you know, the, prior to that. They started in about 2004 copying my material. And so here we are. Finally, we get a lander that goes right down to a comet nucleus and conclusively proves that what they're saying is patently false. And so anyway, that's very good. By the way, they claimed they support Velikovsky, but Velikovsky's claim was that comets were big and became planets. And so how could a little comet nucleus that was losing rock, converting into water, whatever, however that works, that's certainly a good one. It takes, I think, a miracle to do that. How do you convert rock into water? But that's what they were claiming. But at any rate, their so-called electric comet model doesn't make any sense. It's not true. The data is in now, the close-up, close-range data. Nothing is coming off the comet nucleus. But how could that support Velikovsky when, in fact, they are saying that this chunk of rock is being eroded away and goes away with time? You know, so, you know, those kind of contradictions, they're not scientists, so how could they even imagine a scientific result when they're not scientists? You know, they're just, anyway, enough of that. But any theory that claims that the material is coming off the comet nucleus now completely disproven. The only one that's left is my plasma discharge comet model. And that's where the tail material is coming in from the outside. That powder they're seeing on the nucleus is powder that is formed, and that's the chemical mixing that goes on in the electric field as those individual atom species come in, the carbon, the hydrogen, the nitrogen, oxygen, etc., and all the other ones, sulfur, many other chemical species, atomic species mixing and becoming larger on the comet nucleus. And by the way, I hope that nobody at NASA gets the bright idea. They've already done this. They've flown the Stardust mission through the tail of a comet, came back, brought the viruses back from the comet tail and brought them back to Earth. The spacecraft, when it came into the atmosphere, lost control and crashed, and releasing viruses into the environment that were brought back from the tail of a comet. But can you imagine the amount of virus material that's on the nucleus of that comet? It's just unbelievable. And so, at any rate, the end result is that comets certainly are not dirty snowballs. The only comet theory that's left to explain what's going on there, and I predicted all of this long, long ago, is the plasma discharge comet model, the one I created back in the good old Cornell days. Actually, I had it developed before then. It was in the Cornell days that I started seeing the data that confirmed what I had done. Secondly, in the pictures that are released, and I have this on my homepage, right? If you scroll down, you'll see the pictures. The photos, these are close-range photos. I mean, very close range, 100 yards away, wide angle from the lander camera. Striated rock. Okay, now where does striated rock come from? What is striated rock? This is the rock that's built up, layered up over centuries, possibly millions of years, layer upon layer upon layer in a water environment under the ocean, primarily is where this happens. Or a vast lake, for example, where the sediment is laid down and then under pressure continually builds up. And then eventually you have a lot of pressure on top of that. So these layers typically are deep down in the earth under severe pressure, and that sand, that material gets compressed and actually forms rock. That's how rock forms. It's severely compressed material, and then instead of being loosely compacted, it actually starts to form chemical bonds, and that makes a rock hard. But it occurs over very long periods of time, and it's layered up and under severe pressure. And then, as a comet nucleus comes by that planet, a large comet nucleus, planet X type object, it rips that, the mountain building occurs, and it rips those layers up. And the way we see it in the Andes, the Himalayas, the Rocky Mountains, all of the mountain ranges of the world have these striated layers thrust up, and you can see them. So I put a picture of striated rock from the Colorado Rocky Mountains upthrust. I put a picture right next to the comet nucleus, and you can see the striations. That tells you very clearly that the old concept that a comet nucleus formed out in the outer solar system where it was cold and the ice and the dust formed and it made this loose composite of dirty snowball, completely incorrect. Because that nucleus was built up under severe pressure inside of a planet that had water activity. And now we have a little chunk of it floating around out there with that striated rock sticking out of the side of the comet nucleus. You can see many other examples in the nucleus where there's deposits of dust, but there's a little space. You can see underneath there, you can see the striated rock also. But this one big outcropping, very clearly striated rock. Now, can you imagine the geologists at the European Space Agency and at other, maybe NASA around the world, looking at this comet nucleus and going, that's striated rock. A geologist, I mean, they study this on Earth. They study it on Mars. They study it. That's the indication that you had water activity and the long-term planetary atmosphere with water, etc., and weather, etc., building this up over millions of years, then that being compressed and then being thrown up, all of these processes required in a water environment. So that piece of a comet nucleus at 67P is part of the internals of a planet that existed. The question is that a planet that used to be in our solar system? Could that be? Or is it a part of a planet that used to be in some other solar system? In other words, there was a massive collision between two planetary-type objects, and when they hit, I mean, this is rock on rock, planet-sized, solid bodies, colliding and blowing them to smithereens. Are we talking Planet X scenario here? Now, why do you think that lead scientist on the European Space Agency at the Paris Air Show news release didn't say anything about that? Like I say, he looked like he had a little bit of pressure on him not to say anything except what he was scripted to say. There's no question the nucleus of comet 67P, the remains, internal remains of a one-time planet that had been blown to smithereens, and the only way that happens is with a collision with another planet. Nuclear bombs can't do that. I don't care what you're talking about. nuclear bombs at the surface, the material goes blasting off the surface, but it does not blast solid rock like that out of the interior. This is the result, and only the result, of a planetary collision in the past. When could that have happened? We don't know. The orbit of 67P is very much planet-like. And so let's ask the question, could the asteroid belt be composed of, at least partially, of an exploded planet? Well, let's go back to a guy named Tom Van Flandert, who championed that idea as he was Richard Harrington's assistant at the Naval Observatory. And so anyway, yeah, this goes back to really, really a long time ago. Van Flandert was championing that idea. But he really couldn't prove it. And so there again lies the crux of the issue. The actual answer is that the majority of material in the asteroid belt is probably captured. But is there a possibility that something blew apart in there? Well, let me say this. When I was at a American Geophysical Union meeting one time, I met a young woman physicist from the countries around the Caspian Sea. Albekistan, I think, she was from Azerbaijan. Let me pull this up here so I can say it correctly. Azerbaijan is how it's pronounced, or Azerbaijan. Anyway, I spoke with this woman quite a bit, and her area of study was asteroids. And what they had discovered by looking at various asteroids, and I think Vesta was one of them, that the chemical composition of the rocks from various asteroids, they could tell down to very fine detail on these asteroids, that one asteroid was a piece, was broken off from another one. So at any rate, they knew that some of these asteroids had been part of a larger rock or asteroid in the past, meaning that they had been blasted apart. So that tells me the statistical possibility that these groups of asteroids somehow were related tells me that, yes, there was a planet back there at some point in history that got blown to smithereens by literally a planetary collision. And how does this happen? Well, what happens is when, let's talk about a big planetary object, a comet comes into the solar system, if they're captured into the prograde direction, that means they're captured into the direction that the other planets are moving, then something like the planet Venus is the result. It causes a lot of havoc, great destruction to planet Earth with close encounters, not a direct collision, but then eventually becomes a planet and mixes in. And the reason it can do that is because of the circularization of its orbit, because of the tail drag of the comet. This is all part of my work, explaining how this happens. However, if the comet nucleus comes in and is captured in a counter, in a retrograde orbit, in the other direction of the rotation, counter-rotating direction, then you have the problem that, yes, these things can collide, and if they go around and around enough, then typically, yeah, something's going to collide, and it isn't going to be good for either one of them. So that means something of Herculean astronomical proportions, two planets colliding, destroying both of them, and then a lot of these pieces, chunks of the planet broken up. So what you're going to find in the asteroids is kind of like a jigsaw puzzle, and that's what this young woman physicist was doing in her studies. And along with, you know, and I think there was a program associated with NASA, certainly not something you hear about, but they were basically taking these asteroids, studying them down to fine detail with spectroscopy, and putting them back together like a jigsaw puzzle, clearly telling you that there was a vast planetary collision back there. But of course, mum's the word at NASA. So they're studying this stuff, boys and girls, grandmas and grandpas, ladies and gentlemen. NASA is studying this stuff, but they're not telling you, the public. The only reason you're finding out about this is because I find it out myself and then release it on this radio show and to you, the public. So clearly NASA understands that a planet was out there. And statistically at this point, I would say, given the amount of material that they're putting together, and by now they certainly have a lot more data on that, it's very clear that this material did not come from some other solar system, because we would, by the time they got here, they would be separated. They would be really not something, you know, they would not have come here like very close together necessarily. They'd be scattered all over the place. But the fact that you can identify them close together in this solar system tells you that that planet was from this solar system. Very interesting material. The next question, of course, is when possibly could this have happened? And here was always the problem with Van Flanders' work. And I had said this to him, and something that you know, that needed to be explained, was that he said that he could trace the orbits of asteroids back to an original single planet. But the problem is over the eons and eons of time, these orbits change, they're affected by perturbations from many other objects, etc. And that became a very unbelievable process, that somehow you could trace the orbits back to an original source. And of course, the problem is with computer rounding errors, etc. It's really an impossible problem given the technology that we have today. A far better way of confirming what he was trying to do, and of course, he didn't have the data at the time. He's dead now. Van Flanders died a number of years ago. And his work, however, would be better confirmed by showing that this jigsaw puzzle effect, where you can take pieces of asteroids spectroscopically and analyze them, put them back together, by computerized, put them back together. And then once you get enough of these, you realize that, hey, these, and then also let's look at the composition of these asteroids. If you have layering striated rock within these asteroids, that tells you that this was not just kind of a minor planet that formed out there, but this was a big planet that had water activity, that had striated rock. And that's this nucleus of the comet 67P also. We see that it has striated rock. That was part of a bigger planet. So it's starting to give the real result. This is a very important real result. And like I say, it's something NASA had been studying, and they must have known this and kept it quiet. But I'm announcing it here on this show that, yes, there was a planet. There's extreme high level of information right now that tells us that there was a planet and was probably out there in that zone between Mars and Jupiter. The question is, when did it happen? When did that thing get blown to pieces by a planetary collision? And now remember, this is not a interaction electrically or anything like that. This is a direct planetary collision. These babies nose to nose collided. And, you know, and over time, they may have had a couple different collisions, but the big one was nose to nose, and they were moving in opposite directions. So this, I'd like to model this sometime, where you have two planets, let's say Earth-sized planets, and look at the velocity that these things meet and the explosion to where you just have pulverized down to almost dust the pieces, etc., that came out of this planetary collision. Wow. And that, so this is becoming proof positive, and it's through my contact with this young physicist from Eastern Europe that I know about this study that's internal to NASA that puts these pieces back together like a jigsaw puzzle. Now we see the comet nucleus of 67P striated clearly from a planet that had internal structure, water systems, etc. Wow. Just one final note about Tom Van Flandern. The group that I call the Ding Dongs, they copy my work, they try and pretend like Electric Universe, whatever. But they always have a handler. and any of these groups that are supported by the government has people who are, you know, kind of befriend them, but really what they are is it's called a handler. Tom Van Flandern for many years was the handler of the Talbot group, the Ding Dongs. And but anyway, very interesting part of that whole story where they denied, this is the point, they denied the existence of Planet X. And I thought, how contradictory Van Flandern. Here he's talking in his own studies. He said, here's a planet that used to be in the solar system and it collided with another planet and just completely destroyed it. Yet he emphatically denied the existence of Planet X. How does that work? How on earth does that work? But anyway, that just shows you how ridiculous some of this is. This, and then, of course, the ding-dongs deny Planet X also. Well, how could you deny Planet X when the whole Velikovsky story is about a Planet X-type object that came from a comet and became the planet Venus? That's what Planet X is all about. But at any rate, you know, don't go there. That's just a ludicrous government-supported disinformation site. And Tom Van Flandern, like I say, was their handler for quite a few years. Moving on to Titan. Okay, Titan in the news today. Here's the situation. For many years, there's a data gathering device on the, it's called the Cassini Plasma Spectrometer. And it's called CAPS. Anyway, it had been analyzing the region around Titan, the large moon with an atmosphere, etc., of Saturn. And the Cassini mission had been making quite a few flybys of Saturn, of Titan, over the years. And they had noticed that there was, every time they came by Titan, there was a sea of electrons around it. And so finally, they have come to the conclusion that this is real, and that also they see the hydrocarbons and other, excuse me, varieties, methane, etc., atomic and molecular species, nitriles, etc., petrol, natural gas, bitumen, all of these chemicals, which are basically organic chemicals, carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen-based chemicals in the region coming off. They said it was coming off of Titan when actually it was coming towards Titan. But basically they saw these, all of the conditions of the plasma discharge comet model. And listen to what they say. Here's an article that just was posted. It says, unlike Earth, Titan has no magnetic field of its own, but is surrounded by Saturn's rapidly rotating magnetic field. Listen to this now, which drapes, forming a comet-like tail around the moon. In 23 flybys which passed through Titan's ionosphere or its magnetic tail, CAPS detected measurable quantities of photoelectrons up to 6.8 Titan radii away from the moon, because they can easily travel along the magnetic field lines. So at any rate, they basically have discovered the fact that Titan is a comet. This is exactly what they're talking about. And they see the photoelectrons. They see them at 24.1 electron volts, which is typical of a one of the species there. But what I want to make here, a point here, that Earth is doing this, going through the same process. Towards the poles, they identify that there are electron clouds. But what they're saying is that this material is being drawn off of Titan, when in reality, as usual, they have it backwards. The material is being drawn into the atmosphere of Titan. And I had a listener write in and ask me about this, and so I did a simple calculation. They're talking about 7 tons of this material being drawn off the atmosphere of Titan on a daily basis. So if you sit down and do the calculation, 7 tons per day, and you look at the size of Titan's atmosphere, its weight in terms of mass, It's 1.19 times the mass of Earth's atmosphere, which is rather interesting in itself. Titan, little Titan out there, has an atmosphere that's far bigger than Earth's atmosphere, and it's that distance from the sun. But if you take 7 tons of that atmosphere out every day, and you span that over 4.5 billion years, guess what, boys and girls? there's no atmosphere left. And so that means that Titan had to begin, supposedly, with an atmosphere twice as big as Earth. Not twice as big, 2.5 times that of Earth. But what it does tell you is that this is something that's contributing to the size of Titan's atmosphere. It's actually, Titan's atmosphere is growing just like the atmosphere of Mars. And so, a strange situation, but NASA always seems to get it backwards. But I want to read on, and it says here that the team found these negatively charged photoelectrons spread throughout Titan's ionosphere and the tail to set up an electrical field. Gee, boys and girls, what does that sound like? The electrical field, in turn, is strong enough to pull the positively charged hydrocarbon and nitrile particles from the atmosphere throughout the sunlit portion of the atmosphere, setting up the widespread polar wind that scientists have observed there. Well, what they're seeing is they're actually seeing the material that's coming into Titan building up its atmosphere. And so, anyway, Titan acting very much like a comet, they can actually measure these, and it's exactly what I've been talking about all along. The Titan is acting exactly like a comet nucleus. And the end result is that Titan is very Earth-like. It has weather, it has rain, it has, of course, these are not water, it's not water rain, it's methane rain because it's much colder there. They have rivers and lakes of methane on Titan. So at any rate, but the other fact here is that Titan really is not that old. Titan is relatively new, and just like Venus, it had its atmosphere completely formed by the time it became a moon of Saturn, when it became captured. And so clearly Titan is acting as a comet. Why is it acting as a comet? Because it's in the central electric field of Saturn. Why does Saturn have an electric field? Because it is a small star. It has its own fusion wind, proton wind. This I've talked about many times before, and I'm just about out of time here. But at any rate, remember to go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. Your purchases, 50% of the profit, go to the Wing Generator Project. So I'm putting in a lot of money into this, too, and I want you to help support this. The link at the very top of my webpage, go to the crowdfunding page and throw in a few bucks, whatever you can. More is better, but $5, $10 would be a wonderful contribution from everybody. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.